Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we've got acclaimed journalist and historian Anita Anand with The Patient Assassin, a true tale of massacre, revenge and the Raj.
Thank you all very much indeed for coming. I can't tell you what a great pleasure it is to be back at this history festival. It is also a great delight. Those of you who know me from the radio will know what I do. It's Any Answers, and it is just such a pleasure to talk about something that is not Brexit related. So thank you from the bottom of my heart for that. So as you quite rightly say, the fulcrum of this talk, now I'm pointing at the right place now. Aha. Yes, here we are. Is Amritsar, the city which you visited when you were just a young man. And Amritsar, for those of you who have not been there, is in the north of India in a place called Punjab, the land of the five rivers. I'm ethnically Punjabi. I was born and brought up here, but my parents, very proud Punjabis indeed. And if you haven't been to Amritsar, you might have seen pictures of its most important landmark, the Golden Temple of the Sikhs. It's the holiest shrine of the Sikhs. And there is a saying that whenever you have a troubled soul, no matter what your faith or creed or religion, you go to the Golden Temple, you sit by the holy tank of water, and your prayers will be answered. This story, unfortunately, is not one of answered prayers or peace. It is one of bloodshed and revenge. But let me take you sort of right back to the beginning. You alluded to the fact that there is a personal connection. There are actually two personal connections I have with this story. I'll come to them in a little while, and it really was just a very strange coincidence that I married the man that I married, and that he too had this link with this terrible story. But let me take you back, first of all, because I think it's important to understand the events which led to the massacre and the events afterwards which then led to the revenge. So, first of all, the man who was in charge of Punjab at the time was this gentleman here. His name is Michael O'Dwyer. Now, in India, that name still is one that will immediately cause eruptions of hatred, particularly in the north. His name is very similar to another protagonist in this story, a man called Brigadier General Dyer. Dyer and O'Dwyer, they're kind of inconveniently similar. And in India, they've both been melded into this one composite Rakshas, or demon, if you like. People refer to Sir Michael Dyer, or Reginald O'Dwyer, as the villain of this piece. He is one of those creatures who sort of entered folklore, and I was brought up to fear that composite Rakshas, that composite demon, because as Punjabis, we all knew the story of Jallianwala Bagh, particularly those of us who had people that we knew who were there that day. Now, Sir Michael, it was important for me to not just write about the man who took revenge for the massacre, the patient assassin, but I wanted to talk about the other people involved, the people who terrified me so much when I was a child, because I find, you know, history is not a comic. People are not two-dimensional. You need to understand the motivations of everybody involved. And for a while, I really resisted writing this book because it meant I would have to understand the humanity of people who had terrified me since I was a child, people like this man. But I did. And one of the ways that I found, the only way I could do it, actually, was to distance myself from that Rakshas, that demon name. I couldn't think about him as O'Dwyer. I could only think about him as Michael or Sir Michael. It sort of allowed me to access the humanity which otherwise, you know, that everything in my history told me did not exist, the humanity of a man and his motivation. So he's very interesting, Michael O'Dwyer. He was born in Tipperary to an Irish Catholic family. And unlike his neighbours, his father was a loyalist. He believed that Westminster's might was right. John O'Dwyer, whom Michael, young Michael, worshipped, did not believe in the Fenian cause. He thought the Fenians were, in his words, thugs and hotheads. He thought that Westminster was the only thing that brought sanity to Ireland, and Michael was brought up on that belief. He also was brought up to fear the nationalists who were the neighbours of his father. His father was the best man in the world, and these men threatened the best man in his life. And indeed, when Michael went off, he was a brilliant young student. He was sent away. He was sort of brought up by the Jesuits. And then he went to Balliol College, where he did exceptionally well. He confounded the expectations of all of his tutors, did the hardest subjects, and came out with the highest marks. But it was while he was away studying for the ICS, the Indian Civil Service, that the worst happened in his life. His father, this giant in his life, was attacked by the Fenians. It was something he always expected would happen because of his father's sympathies. But what we would now call the IRA fired into the family home. His sister and his father were at home. They weren't hit. They escaped. But the stress of that situation brought on, Michael believed, a stroke, a catastrophic stroke in his father, which eventually leads to his death. So Sir Michael O'Dwyer grows up with this hatred of nationalism, this hatred of these people who would wrest control from Westminster. He thinks that they bring chaos, and it is a feeling which you find the roots in Tipperary, but they flourish when he then goes on to work in India after taking his Indian Civil Service exams. Now, the ICS was a tremendously important organization. It was never bigger than 1,200 in number, 1,200 men who were trained to rule India, a population at the time of 300 million. And what they were taught was that India needed an iron hand. When Michael was studying, they were taught stories of the mutiny of 1857. They were taught to fear the mutiny of 1857. And for those of you who know anything about 1857, here in Britain, much is talked about the horrors perpetrated on the women and children in Kanpur. That is one of the most appalling chapters in that history. But in India, if you talk about 1857, it will be referred to as the First War of Independence. And it will be talked about in terms of the almost 1 million people who died as a result of the British then coming in and taking control of India and taking what the Indians call vengeance against the sepoys, whether they were involved or not involved, their families, their villages, and their towns. So history has two parallel tracks depending on where you are. But Michael was on this side of the track. And so that was what he was taught to fear, and he was taught to be on watch for, just like everybody else in the ICS cadre. The thing about the ICS was it was a place where a man like Michael could make his name. He wasn't noble-born, he wasn't an aristocrat, and they weren't poor in Tipperary. In fact, his father was fairly well off. He had land, he had horses, he had cattle. Compared to the neighbours, they were very, very well off. But he wasn't made for life. He had 14 brothers and sisters. He had to make his own way, and the ICS was a place where a bright young man could do that. So he is a man who rises through the ranks and believes that king and country are what matter most of all. He loves his time in India. He loves it not because of the beauty that he's surrounded with. He's posted in Punjab when he first arrives. And if you have ever been to Lahore, which is the first place that he actually is sent to, I think it's one of the most beautiful cities in the world. It's replete with Mughal architecture, the very best of the Persians, the very best of the Hindus, the very best of the Sikhs. It all collides in this glorious clash of architectural beauty. But he didn't see those things. If you look at his autobiography, what he loved about India was British India. The pith helmets, the sundowners, the fact that there was a benevolent control over natives who he thought were not as good. He liked the British enclave. In fact, when he writes about his arrival in Lahore, most of his memories are, and his sweetest memories are around the Kipling family and the Christmas journal that they bring out once a year. That's the part of India that he likes, British Raj India. This is a picture of Michael. I was very delighted to discover this, but on a cheetah hunt. They made a cheetah their pet, you can see in the front. And you can see Michael, it's very difficult, I don't think I can point up there, but he in the pith helmet, second from the left at the back, and his wife and his daughter. And this was the life that Michael enjoyed in India, and he rose rapidly, rapidly through the ranks. What he did not appreciate, what he did not see beauty in, was the actual Indian population. They were not to be trusted. They were seditious, They were mendacious. He categorised them much as somebody, a botanist, I've said this before, would categorise poisonous species. And you can read, if you read his India As I Knew It, you can see he makes these sort of great sweeping generalisations about the natives. And his belief is that they need to be controlled, that they like the control that the British exert over them, except one class, who are really troublesome, and those are the educated Indians, the ones who've travelled to Britain, who've gained an education, and have got ideas above their station. And the one that he hated the most of all was this man here. You may not recognise him, but just if you take the turban off, shave his head and put him in a loincloth, you may recognise him as Gandhi. Gandhi was the worst of the worst, as far as Michael O'Dwyer was concerned, because he was a Brahmin, high caste, educated upstart. Now, at the time when Michael O'Dwyer was in India and in Punjab, Gandhi was not asking the British to leave India. Gandhi was asking for power sharing. That, you know, it's a phrase that is better known in America than it is when it's related to India, but no taxation without representation, a form of those words came out of Gandhi's mouth frequently, that look, we are paying taxes. We are here. Should we not have in our own country some say over the way in which we are governed? And Sir Michael, who very proudly proclaimed himself to be a diehard, did not believe that that was the thing to do. And so people like Gandhi were troublemakers. Even though Gandhi espoused non-violent resistance, and not even that in 1919, but just was asking for more power, he was loathed because he was part of that nationalist bracket that Michael O'Dwyer had been weaned to hate. In 1919, the run-up to this massacre, the Indian troops were coming home. Now, Sir Michael O'Dwyer had prided himself as the Lieutenant Governor of Punjab for sending the most number of Indian men out to fight in the war. So those very first waves of Indian soldiers who went to the front, to France, the Western Front, were largely from Punjab, and sometimes they didn't have the right boots and coats, but there they were anyway, fighting. And they went to war in countries where they didn't necessarily understand what the war was about, they didn't speak the language, and where the cold was as much their enemy as their actual enemy. But they went thinking that when they came back, there may be some gratitude for their sacrifice, that there may be some kind of recompense. And the reason they came back believing that was because that was the kind of thing that Sir Michael had told them when he went around India, telling them to go and sign up. He would tell them that they would be rewarded when they came back, but he would also, it was very much stick and carrot. He weaponized rivalries that existed in India. He told the men of Lahore, you are less than women, you know, if you don't send as many men as Amritsar. He threatened Amritsar, saying, you know what, if you don't send as many as the men in the mountains, they're Muslim, what does it say about your Sikh faith? And so by that method, he was able to send a great number of people to fight. And these people went and fought. And then when they came back, they were expecting all of these riches and rewards. But instead, what they got was an even harsher regime than they had left. During the war, there were special powers conferred to people like Sir Michael, emergency powers, which meant that anyone could be arrested for sedition, that's for criticizing the Raj in any way. You could be arrested without trial, you could be interned. And they came back thinking all of these rules would go away, now the war is over, but instead they carried on under what was the Rowlatt Act. So newspapers could be closed down at a moment's notice, journalists could be arrested and thrown in prison, people could just be picked up off the street without any knowing necessarily what they were accused of, they could be thrown into prison. And this aggravated a whole new class of young men who had been fighting, who were coming back and who expected something better. One of those men you will hear about a little more because he is the protagonist of this story, the patient assassin. As a result of this disappointment, there was a great turmoil of rage building up, particularly in the north, particularly where Michael O'Dwyer was lieutenant governor. And he sensed this and detected that there was trouble on the horizon. But he thought there was mutiny on the horizon. What he saw, this disgruntlement that he was facing, he thought was the precursor to another bloodbath, just like 1857. And so he dealt with often peaceful demonstrations, Gandhian demonstrations, which did not extol violence, with, again, that iron fist. Again, people were interred, put in camps, and this just built up a pressure cooker of rage. We'll come to Amritsar now, because in 1919, in April, there had been outbreaks of violence. Gandhi had called for a satyagraha, which is, he called it a meditation, but what it was in effect was a general strike. He told people, right, okay, you know, when they'd come back from the war, his eyes too had been opened to the fact that no matter what the Indians do, they're not going to be given more freedom. Actually, I should tell you, Gandhi was one of the chief recruiting officers of Indians into the British Army. He went around and he was actually vilified by his fellow nationalists for going and beating the drum for Britain, telling his young men, his young countrymen, to go and fight for the British. But when they came back and when he saw the Rowlatt Act was rolling out and there were no freedoms and there was no more air to breathe, he turned against the British and started to say they must go. He no longer wanted to share power with them. He wanted them to leave. Now, this only heightened the aggravation between him and Michael O'Dwyer. Michael O'Dwyer says that Gandhi should not be allowed into Punjab, his province. He doesn't want him anywhere near the place. Gandhi's on a train in April coming towards Punjab. He's been invited to speak by two leaders in Amritsar who want him to talk about non-violent protest. They too are worried about this building rage in their city, and they want Gandhi to remind people who follow them that violence is not the answer. We can resist without violence. Gandhi's stopped on the train and he's sent back. Now, before he is able to reach Bombay again, the rumours fly around that the British have taken him in and they are going to execute him. And there is a great wave of anger that floods as far as Ahmedabad, which is then present-day Gujarat. And so sporadic episodes of violence are breaking out. And these are getting closer and closer to where Sir Michael is. And so this sort of, oh, it's almost like he predicted this outbreak of violence. And the Indians say, well, he caused the violence that he predicted. And so it was a self-fulfilling prophecy that he had been a part of. In April, there had been marches through the streets of Amritsar. There is a festival called Ram Naomi, which is sacred to the Hindus. And normally castes divided and creeds divided in India. So if the Ram Naomi procession was taking place, Hindus would march in saffron and Muslims, Christians and every other creed would stand back and let them pass. But in 1919, Ram Naomi had taken on a more political aspect. Gandhi had been banned, and suddenly Hindus and Muslims were marching together. And in between the religious chanting of Ram Naam Satyah, the kind of things that they normally said, they were shouting, Gandhi Ji Ki Jai, long live Gandhi, the man who had been banned. To make matters worse, Michael O'Dwyer then decides to arrest these two Gandhian leaders who are trying to keep a lid on the protests that are going on in Amritsar. Two men, Satyapal and Kitchalu. And they are invited to a meeting. They think they're going to discuss Gandhi's arrival to Amritsar, that he's going to be granted permission to come to Punjab. And instead, they are arrested, taken out of the back door, and spirited away. And their followers don't know what's happened to them. For all they know, these men are going to be executed by nightfall. And so this wave of violence sweeps through Amritsar. And there are Westerners who are caught up in it. Two bank clerks are killed. A woman missionary called Marcella Sherwood, who's completely blameless, is cycling through one of the very narrow gullies in Amritsar, and she's pulled from her bicycle, and she's beaten, well, the rioters think to death, but she escapes. She escapes because an Indian family take her in and they save her and they hide her and they direct the mob elsewhere. The mob is more ferocious than it would have been because when these two leaders are taken away and spirited away, a peaceful deputation has gone to talk to the head of this civil government, a man called Irving in Amritsar, to say, look, where are they? Could you please bring them back? Where are these men? And instead of answering the questions, this crowd is fired upon and men fall dead. So this cycle of violence builds to a crescendo, but almost as suddenly as it builds, it dies down. And on the 11th and 12th of April 1919, this flare-up of violence dies down and is peaceful. But Sir Michael thinks he was right. That flare of violence that happened after Satyapal and Kitchley were taken away, after the firing on the protesters in Amritsar, he thinks, is the prelude to a mutiny. So this man then arrives in Amritsar. His name is Reginald Dyer. He is a brigadier. He isn't based in Amritsar, he's based in nearby Jalandhar. And he arrives in Amritsar with the purpose of bringing this restive city to heel. He sends out his men into the city, which is still burying its dead from these 2 days of rioting that have occurred. And he issues a drum proclamation. So drummers go around the city announcing new edicts. You are not to gather in groups. You are not to have political meetings. It is very arguable as to how far this message proliferates. If anyone has ever been to Amritsar, as you have, we joke about Amritsar. It's a city of crows. It's one of the noisiest cities in all of India. You cannot hear yourself. If I was talking to you, you wouldn't be able to hear me, sir, because the noise there in the third row would be so great. Amritsar is a noisy, noisy city. And yet this drum proclamation is meant to have informed everybody in the city, in a medieval city of narrow gullies and alleyways, that this is the new man in town and these are the new rules. On the 13th of April, at a place called Jallianwala Bagh, Dyer makes his stand. Now, this is the entry. Jallianwala Bagh translates as the Garden of Jalla. Jalla was a servant of Maharaja Ranjit Singh, one of the Sikh kings of Punjab. To call it a garden is rather prosaic. It's about the size of 4 football pitches, and it's dusty, and it's flat, and there really was nothing in it in 1919. There was a tree, a native people tree, and a well in the middle, and otherwise it's hemmed in by tenement buildings. So it's just surrounded. There's a very narrow entrance. This is the entrance. It still is the entrance today if you go. 3 men walking shoulder to shoulder would find it very hard to walk into that garden. Dyer has 2 machine gun mounted cars and 50 riflemen. And he sees the entrance and he's irritated because he can't drive his vehicles in. Later, he will admit that if he could have driven them in, he would have used the machine guns on top of the vehicles as well. This is a garden that is teeming with 20,000 men, women, and children that day. There's a political meeting going on, which has been hastily convened after Gandhi has been sent back and these 2 political leaders have been arrested. But that's a very small proportion of the people who are there that day. People who arguably may or may not have known about the drum proclamation 24 hours before. The majority of people are in this garden on that day because it coincides with Vaisakhi, which is the harvest festival, which is the biggest festival in all of Punjab. Thousands of people pour into the city. There's a cattle fair, a horse fair. People come to do deals. They come to give thanks for the harvest in the Golden Temple. They come to eat, drink, and make merry. Amritsar is a party city. He marches his men in. He tells them to take their position on a raised bank on the north side of the garden, and without issuing a single word, telling people to disperse, he tells his men to fire on 20,000 men, women, and children. 20,000 unarmed men, women, and children. Not only are they told to fire, but they are told to direct their fire into the thickest parts of the crowd. So that is the tree that stands on its own in the middle of this dusty field where people are desperately trying to get out of the way of the bullets. So splinters and flesh are flying. We know this because of eyewitnesses, not just Indian eyewitnesses, British eyewitnesses who stood beside Dyer as he gave the order. We know from those eyewitnesses that he ordered his men to wheel around to the perimeter walls where people were trying to get over the walls and escape. And bodies build up in pyramids around that perimeter wall. The youngest victim that day was 8 months old. The oldest was a man in his 80s. They fire for 10 sustained minutes. 1,650 bullets are fired on 20,000 men, women, and children. and then he leaves. As quickly as they marched in, they march out. No medical aid is provided to the people in that garden. A curfew is declared that night, so they can't bring anybody in to tend to the wounded, and they can't bring the bodies out. There are heartbreaking accounts, some of which are in the book, all of which were unbearable to read. One of a woman who sits by her husband's body, tries to pull it out from this pool of blood. She just wants to get it. She keeps saying, to a dry place, to a dry place. And she has to keep a vigil by her husband's body all night with a stick to keep the wild dogs away from his corpse. The tenement buildings all around mean that there are eyewitnesses all the way around who can do nothing but watch these people bleed to death. And this is where my personal connection comes in. Because this man, my grandfather, was there in the garden that day. His name is Lala Ishwardas Anand. He was a young kid of 17. He wasn't political. He had come because of Vaisakhi. He'd come to do a scrap metal deal. He lived up in the mountains near the Khyber Pass. And this was his first big trip to go and buy secondhand sewing machines, refurb them, and bring them back to sell on around the region. And he'd come to meet two of his friends who were Amritsaris, and he'd left them and he'd said, look, I'll just be back, just hold my food, I'll be back in 10 minutes, I've just got to go to the market, give this man some money and I'll be right back. But he never sees his friends again, because by the time he starts returning back to the garden, Amritsar is a city of wailing. He can't get close to it. And instead he runs and he hides. And it takes him until morning when the curfew is lifted to find out that his two friends are dead. And my grandfather lived with survivor's guilt for the rest of his life. He never got over it. I never knew him. He died before I was born. But my father and my father's brothers would say he was a silent, crumbled man. I mean, we now know this to be PTSD and all sorts of other names we can give it now. He went blind early in life, my poor old grandfather, and when people came to commiserate with him, he would say, do not have any pity for me, because God granted me my life that day. It is only right that he take the light from my eyes. So you said about a personal connection. That is one personal connection. There was another young man in that garden who was a similar age to my grandfather. The legend has it that this young man, whose name was Udham Singh, was serving water that day to the people gathered in the garden. And that he was there when the bullets started to fly, and he was there in that interminable night of horror as he heard the screaming turning to whimpering, turning to silence. In India, everybody knows this story of this young man, Udham Singh, who reaches into the ground as the first light hits Jallianwala Bagh, and he picks up a handful of dark earth, heavy with blood, and he says, no matter how long it takes, no matter where it takes me, I am going to kill the men who did this with as little mercy as they have shown my people. He is the patient assassin of this book. Now, Udham Singh had in his sight Brigadier General Dyer, but also Michael O'Dwyer. You know, in India they may conflate those names now. Back in 1919, he knew only too well who these two men were. And there are eyewitness accounts that say he went to the Golden Temple and he swears this oath by the water of the temple that he will kill these men, and that is what his life means from this point on. But he is a man with no agency. He is a man who has no hope of getting close to people like Michael O'Dwyer or Reginald Dyer. He is an orphan. He loses his parents by the age of seven. His only family is a brother who's a couple of years older than him. And they are given, when he's just five and his brother is seven, to an orphanage in Amritsar. Amritsar is his parent. He's brought up in this orphanage, and his brother dies in the orphanage. So he loses the only family he will ever have. The only person who really truly knows him dies in that orphanage. Amritsar is his parent, his only family. He is one of those young men who goes and signs up to fight in Michael O'Dwyer's war. He goes to serve in Mesopotamia. He's an utter failure in the army. He does not distinguish himself in any way at all. He has a bad attitude, according to his superior officers. He does not take orders very well. And he's sent back. He doesn't have any stories of heroics. He doesn't have any plot of land, and he doesn't have a great fortune to fall back on. All of these things that he thought he would have when he goes back to India, he does not have. So when he comes back, 1919, he is ripe for this idea of resistance. But it isn't violent resistance until the massacre, until he sees Amritsar, his parent, bleeding. And at that point, this man, who is an orphan, who is barely literate, who is a teenager with nothing, and I should also add is low caste. And the reason I say this is important, because where the natives are already much lower than the British who run the country, the lower castes have even less than the natives. They are the lowest of the low. So this young man who makes such a big promise, how is he going to do it? Well, he starts desperately trying to seek around to find anybody who can teach him. Anyone who can teach him how to get to men like Brigadier General Dyer, like Sir Michael O'Dwyer. But nobody takes him seriously. No one takes him seriously in India at all. They think he's just this no-hoper, low caste. What good is he going to be? So he ends up sort of pamphleteering and trying very hard to be taken seriously, but failing to, while all around him, that horror of the massacre doesn't just go away. I mean, people have been talking about the anniversary as if this is something that happened in splendid isolation. Let me tell you, this was not something that happened in isolation. In the days that followed the massacre, arguably, things as bad happened. First of all, that alleyway where the woman missionary was attacked, Reginald Dyer decides to make an example of any Indian who wants to go through that particular alleyway. It doesn't matter if you live there, it doesn't matter if you live on the other side of it. If you want to go through that alleyway and you are a native, you will do so crawling on your belly. These pictures were taken as souvenirs by the people who enacted that particular decree. And there are many eyewitness accounts of people who talk about having boots and rifle butts put into their backs so that they crawl even deeper into the ground like insects. Of refuse piling up, of doctors not coming to visit, anyone who lives in that area, guilt by association. These people who lived in this alleyway may have had nothing to do with the violence of the days which preceded the massacre, but they were all collectively punished. Michael O'Dwyer wants to scare the people even further, so instead of having any kind of retraction or reflection after this massacre takes place, instead he asks for gallows to be constructed in public places so that people will know what will happen to anybody who raises their voice, their head, against the Raj. There are flogging triangles which are erected around the city. Young men are tied to them. They're not tried, they are tied, and they are flogged in front of their neighbors and their friends. Some of them are released without charge afterwards, but again, you have Indian narrations about people passing out, just watching these screaming young men who are tied to these triangles. And then they send in the warplanes. Of course, a wave of revulsion sweeps out from the site of the massacre, and it rolls all the way through the north of India. And to stem that rising tide of revulsion and anger, what does Michael O'Dwyer do? He sends out warplanes to strafe civilians from the sky. There is a horrendous account from a man called Major Carberry, who talks about dropping bombs on natives who are on the road to Gujranwala because he assumes that they are rebels if they are on the road. He completely doesn't take into account that people around Gujranwala will have to use the road to get to Gujranwala. That's where they live. He follows some of these people as they run, shooting them in the back. He follows them as they run into their villages, trying to hide, and shoots through the roofs of those buildings. When he's asked later, did you know whether there were children in there? Did you know whether there were women? Did you know who was in those houses? He said, no, but they were all rebels. It was guilt by association. Udham Singh, therefore, is now festering in his rage against the British. And he can't be taken seriously in India. No one's taking him on. And he's running out of money. He doesn't have any money from this glorious war that he was meant to be rewarded for. So he looks for work. And he looks to Africa, where a lot of Indians were traveling to build the railways for the British, the Ugandan Railway Company. It's called the Lunatic Line because you have to be mad to work on it. So many people die of disease. They're carried off by tigers. There are a pair of tigers. There are lots of reports of these tigers working together and carrying off natives who are working on this railway line. And that's where Udham Singh is finally taken seriously, because he meets other anti-colonialists working on this line. And they take him more seriously. And they say, you know what? You're a man with potential. We could use you. Let's teach you. And this is the beginning of Udham Singh's transformation. He starts to believe, my enemy's enemy is my friend. Anyone who hates the British as much as I do, I will learn what I can to do what I need to do. And they teach him how to travel on false passports, how to travel with different identities, how to get money from other people who are fomenting any kind of resistance to the British. He travels on the slipstream of these anti-colonialists back to India and becomes enveloped in the Gadar movement. Now, you know, this is a really contemporary story. This discontented, angry young man is immediately swept up by militant radicals who see how they can use a man with such anger as this. And the Gadars operate primarily, they've been chased out of Punjab by Sir Michael O'Dwyer, but they operate in California. And that is where Udham Singh then drifts to America to learn more from this organization that can teach him to be an assassin. And they do. They teach him very, very well. He lives among the immigrant quarters in Little Italy. He works on the Ford assembly line. He works at the Hudson airplane factory. But he can't work as an Indian because Indians aren't employed in that company. So he takes on another persona. He becomes Frank Brazil, the Puerto Rican. He learns how to change, to adapt, to become invisible. America teaches an Indian how to look like a Westerner, to walk with a straight back, to talk English. America is also the one time that he has a chance to have happiness, to have part of this American dream. What he sees in America in the 1920s is a place full of promise where caste means nothing. You know, in his own country, he's burdened by his caste. But here in America, even though the Gadars are kind of his sponsors and his brethren, he sees Babe Ruth, a reform schoolboy who is worshipped by the Ivy League as much as he is worshipped by the people who work on the Ford assembly line. Men break out of caste in America, and for a while, he is seduced by this life, this promise of you work hard, you earn money, you pay for your very smart clothes. He becomes very much a dandy while he's in America. He also falls in love. He gets himself a wife. She's Mexican, her name is Lupe, and he has two children by her. His story could have ended there. But like the princess and the pea, this is a man who can never find comfort or peace or a night's sleep because this vow is eating away at him. He promised. He promised he would do this. And so he jettisons this wife and two children, just as he will jettison in his life everybody who ever loves him on this trajectory to vengeance. In 1927, one of the people he wants to kill dies of natural causes. Brigadier General Dyer dies in England, and he dies tortured by what has happened in his past. You know, there's a very moving account, I've included it in the book, of his last moments. He's with his daughter-in-law, Phyllis. It's a terrible electrical storm over Long Ashton, which is where he's living. His wife has bought him a dairy in seclusion to live away from prying eyes. He doesn't go out, he doesn't talk about his time in Punjab, he doesn't want to. If anyone wants to know what happens to him, I do go on, but you know, ask me questions about this and I can tell you afterwards what happens to Dyer and O'Dwyer when they come back to England. But during this long electrical storm, the lights go out and Phyllis tells Michael O'Dwyer, who's had a stroke and is looking fretful on the bed, "Don't worry, this will pass. Don't worry, the lights will come back on." And he says, "I don't want this to pass. I want to meet my maker. Some say that I did right, some say that I did wrong, and I want to know for sure." And he dies later that night. Michael O'Dwyer, on the other hand, never has a moment's pause in his life. He comes back to England and he defends what happened in Amritsar during his office. He defends his Brigadier General to the hilt, and he keeps arguing for this iron fist to govern India. It needs to be harder. If anything, it needs to be stronger than before. That's his argument. In 1927, when Brigadier General Dyer dies, he gets what is almost, looks like, it isn't, but it looks like a state funeral. You know, he's carried on a gun carriage. The streets are lined with mourners, and you know, the regiment walks behind him in tears. He's given a funeral with all honours in central London. And this just compounds Udham Singh's rage. So there is no chance that this man is going to settle down and have a happy life, because these things keep reminding him of his promise. So eventually, Udham Singh makes it to England in the 1930s. He ends up here at last. But it isn't as easy as you'd think to kill men who are as important as Sir Michael O'Dwyer, the only man left now on his list. He goes and he plugs into this network of peddlers who exist, the early wave of immigrants who came from Punjab to England. They weren't given jobs because they were the wrong colour. They weren't allowed to work. They often had doors of boarding houses slammed in their faces. But what they did do is they became self-employed. So a lot of these young men from the Punjab in particular, who either had served in the army or had brothers who had worked in the army, came to the capital. And they worked as peddlers because they could buy wads of cloth and clothing. They're not perishable. They would put them on bicycles if they were lucky, on their backs if they weren't. And they would travel to far corners of the country selling dungarees and hosiery. There's a second link that I have to this story, because my husband's family were peddlers. That's how they first came to this country. And Udham Singh becomes supposedly a peddler, one among them. He has multiple different addresses. Every single address that he lives in thinks it's his only address, that they are his only friends, but he's establishing a network across the country, not just to find out Sir Michael's movements and where best he can get him, but he's also doing work for his new friends. Not just the Gathers, my enemy's enemy is my friend. Somehow this young, orphan, low-caste man with no hope in 1919 is suddenly consorting with the Bolsheviks. He's flitting in and out of Moscow. He's flitting through Eastern Europe. He's traveling through Germany in the run-up to war, where Hitler and his race politics are gaining momentum, but where the Nazis are not averse to putting some muscle behind the enemies of the British. They want to destabilize the British as much as anyone else. And suddenly, Udham Singh has these new friends, rubles in his pocket, and he is on the radar of Special Branch and MI5. But they lose sight of him as he dips in and out of this network of peddler houses. Sometimes he doesn't even bother to hide out of sight. This man is a swaggering dandy by the time he comes to England. He's a hit with the ladies. They love him. He has many girlfriends of many different colours. He also takes a job acting as an extra in movies in the Denham studio. So this is Elephant Boy, where he's an extra playing a native in a studio that's decked out to look like the Indian jungle in Denham. So, you know, he really stands out amongst his peddler friends as having this cachet and this swagger. He's a romantic figure. But still, MI5 and Special Branch lose sight of him. The IPI, the Indian Political Intelligence Unit, which keeps tabs on him coming in and out of Eastern Europe, flitting in and out of Leningrad and back to London, they lose track of him. I'm going to now flick forward. There's an awful lot of sort of twists and turns in this tale, but I'll take you to the day which which sort of leads to the culmination of his bloody dream, at least. It's March. It's 1940. The country is gripped by war, and there is a meeting taking place in a hall called Caxton Hall, which happens to be, bizarrely, as far away from the House of Parliament, Houses of Parliament, as Jallianwala Bagh was from the Golden Temple. It is a meeting of the great and the good of the Raj. The Secretary of State for India will be there. Former Lieutenant Governors of provinces of India will be there. The former Governor of Bombay will be there. Most important of all, Michael O'Dwyer will be there. Udham Singh, this Indian, somehow manages in full sight of a fully white audience, without a ticket, to walk into Caxton Hall, to wait calmly as the speeches take place, with his back to the wall. We have boxes and boxes of eyewitness accounts from that day. He watches, he pops a boiled sweet into his mouth. He seems to smile when some of the speeches are taking place. And then just as everybody is rising to leave, he walks very calmly to the front of the hall where the great and the good have gathered in a knot. So the Secretary of State, Michael O'Dwyer, Lord Lamington, Lord Zetland, all of these people in a little knot, Louis Dane at the front, and he reaches out his hand to Michael O'Dwyer. Michael O'Dwyer must have thought he was going to shake his hand because he turns his body and, according to the post-mortem report, must have seen the gun only at the last minute because he tries to shield himself. Udham Singh fires the gun once at point-blank range, and it goes straight through Michael O'Dwyer's heart. He then fires almost instantaneously again, and the second bullet follows the same trajectory, a parallel course through that man's chest and through his heart. It goes through him before he even has a chance to fall to the ground. Michael O'Dwyer dies in a pool of blood, much like many of the people did in Jallianwala Bagh that day.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.